I'm going to talk about some populations of Jerusalem crickets that we looked at in the Santa Monica Mountains north of LA, and what seems to be impacting the structure of this population. And first, I'd like to acknowledge all the people that worked on this project, particularly Eric Llewellyn and Joe Dees, who were both students at San Diego State University and collected almost all of the molecular data. David Weissman from the Cal Academy, who's been working on Jerusalem crickets for the past, I don't even know now, maybe 30 years. And his work's been invaluable to mine. Andrew Bohanek allowed us to do all of the genetic work in his lab while ours was being built at the USGS. And Robert Fisher is my colleague at the USGS. I'd also like to thank the National Park Service, particularly Gary Busteed and Seth Riley, Katie Semple Delaney, who worked on a similar project at UCLA on some other organisms. And then the work was funded by our center, the Western Ecological Research Center, the USGS. So here's my requisite metapopulation slide. Basically, really loosely, you can just define a metapopulation as a set of populations connected by gene flow. And as other people have talked about earlier in this session, the strength of this connection is influenced both by historical and recent factors. And these can include natural habitat heterogeneity, topographic features that may act as barriers or dispersal corridors, the behavior of the organism in question, ecological interactions with other species in the ecosystem, and then perhaps layered on top of all of that are anthropogenic effects, and the one that I'll be focusing on here is habitat fragmentation. So Southern California, where this work took place, is a hotspot for biodiversity and endangerment. And the reasons for this are basically that habitat loss and fragmentation because of urbanization are threatening biodiversity. And just a couple statistics at the bottom. In 2000, during the census, they estimated that about 60% of California's population reside in the southern counties. And in that area, about 400 plant and animal species are considered endangered or threatened. So there's been a lot of work that's focused on the effects of fragmentation, particularly in Southern California. The reported ecological effects are largely negative. They include competition with exotics. And we heard a talk about ants in Southern California that illustrates that. Modification of behaviors. This has been found typically in large carnivores. Changes in species composition, and then, of course, overall loss of species diversity are also common themes. And even species that appear to persist relatively well in fragments may not actually be doing as good as they appear. Reduced dispersal will then affect the genetic connectivity among populations. This can, of course, lead to a decrease in genetic variability due to drift and increased inbreeding in small populations, which in turn has been shown to lead to reductions in survival and reproductive success. Gets even worse, then we may have local population extinction and a decreased probability of recolonizing these empty patches if dispersal is reduced significantly. So we chose to work on Jerusalem crickets, charismatic megafauna of the insect world in Southern California. And the main question we were interested in addressing was how urban fragmentation has altered population genetic structure in a fairly widespread species, but also a low dispersing species. And just a little background on Stenopalmatis Jerusalem crickets. They're very large insects, they're ground dwelling and flightless. They have acoustic mate recognition systems. They produce songs by drumming their abdomens on the ground. And work that David Weissman has done over the past 30 years has revealed that there are many more species than have been described to date. Probably 70 or 80 species in the U.S., 30 to 50 of those just in California. And the species that we worked on is undescribed, but we're calling it Stenopalmatis Santa Monica for right now. However, it is endemic to a wider area of Southern California. And it can be distinguished from other co-occurring crickets based on a combination of its calling song pattern, morphological characteristics, some cytology, and also genetic differentiation. Now, Jerusalem crickets, I think, are really good indicators of fragmentation effects because they have low dispersal ability. This species has a fairly short generation time, about a year, although species in the genus vary, and higher elevation species may take 2 to 3 years to develop. And these two factors lead to a potential to accumulate detectable genetic changes over the time scale of urbanization in Southern California. And in the area we worked in, this is roughly 50 years. And I don't have any Google Earth maps, but here's a map of a broad look of our study area. It's right on the county, Ventura County line and Los Angeles County line there. We worked mainly in the Simi Hills, which is a very fragmented area, mainly housing developments, and then more contiguous habitat in the Santa Monica Mountains. And then I also pointed out, oh, I guess I have to use the mouse, huh? Here we are in San Diego. So we're a little ways north. Well, we're a little ways south, but the study site's a little ways north. Here's a close-up of our study area. So the green areas here are natural vegetation. Then we have urban areas in gray. We have two major highways, the 23 and the 101. Both of these are fairly large freeways, 5 to 6 lanes, I believe, on either side. Average daily traffic volumes of close to 100,000 cars per day on both. These areas in here are mainly more residential, and we sampled crickets and some fairly small habitat fragments. These ones with the S's are all under 1 kilometer square. Some slightly larger fragments, and then down here off the map, south of the 101, we sampled in some more contiguous open habitat. Now, of course, this development didn't happen overnight, almost so, but not overnight. So the National Park Service put together a pretty nice series of maps that shows the development in this region over time. So I'll just go through some of those for you here. So starting in the 1930s, and this is just looking at buildings, not roads. It gets a little complicated when you start adding in the roads. 1930s, not a whole lot of development. The developed areas are starting to show up in red here. The fragments that we worked in are outlined. And everything else we can kind of assume is fairly open. So over time, we can see development increasing in the 1950s. By 1960, we're starting to see some of the major subdivisions appear. By the mid-1960s, a few of these fragments are already completely isolated. 1970, 75, 80, 85. Big housing boom in 1990. Moving on to present day. So it's pretty much what the area looks like today. So using that time series, we can refine the questions actually a little bit. So we can ask, has urban fragmentation led to any increase in genetic divergence among populations? And we can also ask if there's an association between that temporal pattern of development, or the temporal pattern of isolation of these fragments, and genetic divergence. So just moving backwards, I guess, a little bit to tell you about how we collected these guys. We collected these out of pitfall arrays. These were initially set up by the U.S. Geological Survey to sample lizards and snakes and small mammals, but they do a really good job of capturing some of these large invertebrates, too. And it's basically a series of, I think, 7 buckets. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, 7 buckets, 5-gallon buckets, connected by drift net fencing. And we looked at arrays in 10 fragments in the Simi Hills. And then we had 5 more areas in more contiguous habitat south of Highway 101. Samples were collected in 2001 and 2002 for the most part, though we did go back in 2005 and supplement some of those collections. So here's the wider study area that includes some of these sites that we collected down in the more contiguous area. Our laboratory methods were pretty standard. We looked at a total of 164 specimens. We extracted DNA from leg tissue. We looked at mitochondrial DNA sequencing. And then we also used intersimple sequence repeats. And these are anonymous nuclear dominant markers. They're fairly similar to RAPIDS, but much more reliable. They're considered to be on par with AFLPs. And the reasons for this are twofold. You use very long specific primers and high PCR temperatures. And using this approach, we came up with 38 loci to analyze. And the analyses that I'll present today are also fairly standard. I'm just going to show you basically F statistics, which are a measure of genetic divergence among sampling locations. And we analyze this mainly in an isolation by distance framework, meaning that we measure the divergence between all pairs of populations and then tested for a correlation with geographic distances among populations. And then we used partial Mantel tests to look for an association with fragmentation or fragment age while controlling for geographic distance. Just overall, if we look at a global statistic, we found that both of our markers, CO1 and ISSRs, significant differentiation among populations. This doesn't really tell you too much, though, about which populations are driving the signal here. I would also like to point out that our estimates from CO1 are quite a bit higher. Our Phi-ST estimate was about 0.6, and our theta from ISSRs was an order of magnitude lower, but both significantly different from zero. Also with both markers, we saw a fairly strong isolation by distance pattern. And then now just looking at the mitochondrial DNA, if we just look at a comparison of populations that are separated by urban areas versus a comparison of populations that are separated by more contiguous habitat, basically we saw a significant positive relationship, meaning that fragments had higher genetic divergences than populations in contiguous habitat. And we also saw that the temporal scale was very important. So then if we looked at, you know, how long have these two patches been separated versus how long have these two been separated, we also got a significant association. So this, I think, is actually a pretty interesting result. Older fragments are more divergent than those separated more recently is what we found. And there are a couple possibilities as to why this is. Now, given the relatively short time since urbanization began, I think it's unlikely that an equilibrium between drift and gene flow has been reached for these populations. So in such a situation, we might expect that genetic divergence will increase with time until a new equilibrium is reached. Now with the ISSR markers, the nuclear markers, we actually didn't see any association with urban fragmentation or fragmentation edge, or fragment age, sorry. So then we went back to the drawing board here, or just looked at, you know, what other barriers there might be in our system. And I just looked at whether the highways posed a barrier. So we have Highway 101, which was became a highway in 1949. It was probably a fairly major roadway before that as well. And Highway 23, which became a highway in 1967. So if we just look at those two barriers, we do see some positive correlation, both with just highway presence and then also with the two highway ages, although not as strong as with mitochondrial markers. So we do have some discrepancies between our mitochondrial DNA results and our nuclear markers. There are many possible explanations for this. Could just be stochastic lineage sorting in the different genes. We could have differences in the mutation rates among genes. We also have differences in effective population sizes between the two genes, or two groups of genes. Mitochondrial DNA has roughly a quarter the effective population size of nuclear markers, if you assume equal sex ratios. So mitochondrial DNA may sort more quickly in revealing a stronger signal of fragmentation until genetic equilibrium has been reached for both sets of markers. And we may also have sex bias dispersal. So in Jerusalem crickets, when we did our sampling, we did find that we pretty often caught about as many females as we did males over the course of a couple years. But they were staggered. So what we would see is we would catch a wave of juveniles, then we would catch a wave of males, and then we would catch a wave of females, adult females. And so probably males are moving around a bit more during the mating season than females. We also know that males in this group produce a shorter and more frequent mating call than the females do, and it's quite a bit so. In other insects, the song differences have been found to reflect different mating strategies, so that females would remain stationary while calling, and males are making short drumming bouts in between, trying to locate the females that are calling in response. And it's possible that males may be willing to cross short distances of unsuitable habitat in search of mates, particularly, I guess, if they can still hear a female drumming. And it's unclear how far those drums will travel, both over a natural substrate and an unnatural one. My big PowerPoint move there. That's supposed to be a male finding a female. So basically, in conclusion, we can see that urbanization has potentially led to a loss of genetic connectivity among metapopulations. I think what's particularly interesting is that time appears to be an important variable. We've also seen similar genetic patterns in other species in the same exact study area. Bobcats have been studied, as well as coyotes, and more recent work on western fence lizards and sideblatch lizards have all really shown the same pattern. Although in these larger animals, the greatest genetic breaks are along those two major highway routes. And you're not seeing as much of the fine scale genetic structure that we found, at least with mitochondrial DNA in the crickets. I also didn't show the data, but mitochondrial genetic diversity is also strongly correlated with fragment size and fragment age. So that the very smallest reserves that we looked at contain significantly less genetic diversity than larger ones. And this is the case even though our detectability in these fragments seems to be about the same as in these larger areas, so that the number captured per unit sampling effort didn't differ dramatically between these sites. So there are several implications here. Basically that the loss of connectivity leads to a lower potential rescue through immigration. Decoupling of evolutionary processes among populations may occur. Each can sort of go its own way. And probably most importantly, that the loss of diversity in these small fragments may be equated with the loss of adaptive potential. So I think our work also kind of maybe brings into question some of the utility of urban micro-reserves, and these have been touted particularly for invertebrates. For protecting some amount of invertebrate diversity in urban landscapes. While I think that it's definitely true and worthwhile to slow the loss of biodiversity in urban landscapes with these, I think we also have to be aware that they may not protect certain aspects of diversity over the long term if habitat connectivity between these reserves is severed. And we may need to start to become very creative in the ways in which we help organisms overcome this loss of connectivity. And luckily, Disney's already started working on this. And that's all I have. Haven't been able to do any mark recapture studies. It's they're actually quite difficult to find. And some of our attempts to do that in some other habitats have been unsuccessful so far. Just getting enough numbers to recapture Mark, and or to capture initially in Mark and let go. But that's definitely something I want to do. Definitely our genetic results now from this species and then another species I've also worked on both confirm that when you're looking at these more open landscapes, you see much higher genetic connectivity than you do in this fragmented landscape. So, you know, there might be a bit of movement going on in the natural conditions, I guess. Yes.
Do you have a data set available to ask the question, what's the effect of distance and time in completely unfragmented landscapes versus fragmented? Looking at your map about where the sites were, like, trying to get a full control out of it to assess
yeah.
the impact of fragmentation in areas that aren't fragmented and look at distance.
Right.
Associated in a population that's not fragmented, and then compare that to other side growth.
Right. Well, we sort of attempted to do that in the best way that we could using the populations that were south of the 101. You know, there is still some development down there, but it's
right.
much less so than
just,
north.
Those points didn't look. The distribution of those points in the unfragmented area or in the four areas, whatever you want to call them. The distribution spatially of those points did not look any
no,
distribution
no.
points up.
No, it's certainly not.
How that affects the analysis.
Well, I think it could. I mean, we've definitely got we've got some long distances because we looked at the points that were in those two, maybe I should go back to the slide, the two core parks. And we have some very short distances, but we don't have any of the middle distances. So we've got, you know, these over here, which I consider not fragmented from these
right.
over here for my analysis today. Or not as fragmented, I guess. So, you know, that comparison definitely shows, you know, that there's some difference between the control or the non-fragmented versus the fragmented. But no, it's not a perfect study design. And we actually do have...
The difference between the some far distance and unfragmented, is the genetic diversity less there than some far distance and fragmented? Does that make sense?
It's mainly at the shorter distances that you're seeing the change, and I didn't put the graph up. But if you look, when you get to those very, you know, the largest distances across here, you know, versus the smaller distances in here, the main place where you're seeing the most difference is across these small distances.
So is that difference across small distances and fragmented north of the 101 similar to or greater than small distances?
It's much greater than. Yeah. Although not for the ISSRs, there's no pattern there. Yeah.
So what kinds of things do you think about when you mentioned, you know, connecting some of these fragmented things? What can be done with the transplant organisms or?
You know, I don't really know. In fact, you know, there are actually several underpasses under these highways. But whether or not these are appropriate corridors for invertebrates, I don't think anyone's thought about too much. I went back through and there have been some studies on what larger animals are using these. And most of the ones that are under this highway right here are being used by things like skunks and house cats and, you know, all these sorts of things that would love to munch on a Jerusalem cricket if they found one crossing the road there at night. So, you know, whether or not these are viable corridors for invertebrates or crickets in particular, I don't think so. So, you know, building these sort of bridges, I think, would probably be the best approach. When you have a place that's already developed like this, though, it becomes a little difficult. So maybe you have to think about designing some umbrellas. used to balloon one to the other. Or maybe, you know, it was a joke, the assisted migration, but it, you know, might be something to think about. Yeah, I know they've talked about it with butterflies. So it might be something that we have to think about for other organisms as well.
Are they working with mortality source?
I believe they must be. You know, particularly with all of that traffic. And these are very slow moving crickets, if you've ever seen them. I mean, they're just ridiculous. So, you know, we haven't done any of that to, you know, just walk along the roads, mainly because I don't want to become a carcass, too. It's pretty difficult. If you drive any slower than 65 there, you really get nailed. So it's tough. But they must have to be a source of mortality. And even these smaller roads, I think probably these large highways, they even have difficulty getting up onto them because they're berms, they're medians, things that they are probably unlikely to be able to scale. But even some of these smaller neighborhood roads are probably a source of mortality.
So if you emphasize there's no crickets in natural habitats, do they persist at all in the urban areas?
We haven't found any. Occasionally people will call me because they found one in their pool or something, and typically when I ask a few more questions, they usually live right on the edges of some of these areas, and the ones that are drawn to the water are usually infected with parasites like myrmecid worms or something, and probably not, you know, a viable part of the population at that point anyway. But yeah, they're really not too abundant in urban areas. Now, it's different in Northern California. I used to find them in my backyard all the time up in Berkeley. You know, they left our plants and stuff back there. But I'm not sure why, but they just don't persist in the urban areas here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.